I can't remember now, I think 2 Samuel, perhaps 1 Samuel, but it is actually used to describe rape, that he forced himself upon her, that we are given that kind of power and authority over the earth, which, by the way, flies completely in the face of the world in which we live, in which we are increasingly enslaved to those who believe that the earth is our master and that all human efforts must be handed over. Paul's here, if you're waiting for one, you can throw your hand up. Right? just one of those many places, folks, for us to be reminded that the Bible is at odds with the world in a lot of ways, some more subtle and obvious or less obvious than others. And the earth-worshipping world that we have now is not the way that it is supposed to be. So for those of you just getting the outline, number one, the creation of man is the creation of an earthly kingdom. That's the foundation. That's where we fit in all things. Which brings us then to number two, sin disrupted the plan but did not eliminate the plan. And I hope that you would understand I'm always talking about these things from a human perspective, right? It's important for us to understand that God is never taken by surprise by what happens. And he's never trying to fabricate a play on the fly, so to speak, as to resolve with the latest crisis. So we can come back in the one sense within our sphere of God's sovereignty and know that all of this is working out exactly as he planned. But we also have to deal with it as it's presented to us, which is that man was created in perfection and given a perfect place to live. And to us, our fall comes as a little bit of a surprise. We may not have been expecting that, but that is exactly what happened. So sin disrupts this plan but does not eliminate the plan. Genesis chapter 3, specifically Genesis 3:15, the first mention of the gospel in all of the Bible, that God will himself resolve what is ultimately a conflict between God and Satan, right? We're kind of previewed that in the Garden of Eden. We're previewed that pretty early in the creation story. Again, it is another one of those things that is certainly not flattering to the high value we tend to place upon the very existence of humanity. But we are a part of a conflict that is going on between God and Satan. And that is where we fit, right? What is the ultimate purpose of my life, if you want to get that existential about it, right? It is that I have some role in this great conflict between God and Satan. And this is one of the reasons that it should be obvious in every facet of our life exactly whose side we're on, because there are only two sides to be on. So that's, again, a little different than what we're doing here. But, right, so we were created to be part of an earthly kingdom that God was going to rule on earth through us. Sin disrupted the plan but did not eliminate it. Number three, Noah, Abraham, and David are instrumental humans in the perpetuating of this kingdom. They are not the only humans instrumental in perpetuating it, but right, Noah is the lone survivor. Noah and his family are the lone survivors of God's judgment of flood. And so Noah has a significant part in the kingdom. And there's a covenant that is attached to that. Abraham, of course, is incredibly important because the promise made in Genesis 3 is fulfilled. Big leaps Noah to Abraham and then ultimately to David. And while the New Testament and Jesus' interaction with his enemies rarely, you know, brings Noah into the picture, it frequently brings Abraham and David into the picture. Right? The Jews were never arguing about the role of Abraham or David in the kingdom. They were arguing about Jesus' unrighteous claiming to have their place. So number four, the kingdom will be a God's reign on earth. And I just gave one reference there, but Isaiah chapter 2 is very clear about that, the way that will all play out. Letter B, it is centered geographically and spiritually upon Jerusalem. And of course, again, I'm assuming that you know that, you know, but I'm not going to keep talking about it, that I am presenting, for lack of a better word, our, by our meaning the pretty much dispensational Israel and the church are not the same entity position as opposed to lots of other positions that are out there. And we're really going to have to get into a little bit of that when we get into next week when we begin to work our way through the Olivet Discourse. How you view these things broadly is going to have an impact on how you view them narrowly. So I'm anticipating a kingdom that will be God's reign on earth that is centered geographically and spiritually upon Jerusalem. And that, letter C, God's reign on earth through the throne of David. Right? That this will be a reign of God on earth through the throne of David. And this, of course, is one of the reasons why David is an instrumental human in perpetuating the kingdom. So that I believe, to go off just a little bit of a tangent, right? I think that David will, like believers, be resurrected and will exist as the king of Israel. But and Jesus will have the throne that rules the entire globe. And then the apostles will have, the 12 apostles will have their role as judging the nation of Israel. Okay? So three references there, which, again, we've looked at in times past, and we've spent a lot of time last week looking at Psalm number 110, that little psalm, Isaiah 9:7, Luke 1:32, New Testament prediction that Jesus will sit upon the throne of David. Number five, when Jesus comes to earth, the incarnation, presenting himself as king, he is rejected by his people, the Jews. And the verse that we've been using with the chapter we've been using, particularly with reference to the Gospels, is Matthew chapter 12. Of course, we know John chapter 1, he came unto his own and his own received him not. That he was rejected by his people, the Jews, which again puts us right, and we never want to ignore the fact that we live in this reality of this kinds of tensions, that the Bible presents the offer of the kingdom to Israel as a very real possibility. Right? That God wasn't doing some magic trick or smoke and mirrors with a fake offer. That if they would have said, yes, we want it, he would have said, well, I didn't really mean it. So we accept it as a legitimate and genuine offer of the kingdom. But on the other hand, we recognize that all of God's plan could not come to pass if Israel had accepted it, and God had anticipated that rejection way back in the Old Testament. So again, comes as no surprise to him. So we deal with those kinds of tensions, and folks, we deal with those kinds of tensions in the Scripture all the time. That, right, this is part of the complexity of what we are up against. So anyway, Jesus came to earth, presented himself as the king, and, you know, no accident that when he was crucified, that was the mocking title that was hung over him, was here's the king of the Jews, right? That was what the Jews wanted. That was what the Jews wanted to say about him. Yeah, here's our king. Here's what we think about this man. Which brings me then to point number six. And so the consummation of the kingdom is forwarded in time. And this is my language. My wording on that. The consummation of the kingdom is forwarded in time, but with no other changes. And what I mean by that is that the kingdom being offered to Israel and being rejected by Israel does not change in any way that the kingdom belongs to Israel, so that there will not be other changes to that. In other words, it is not at this point that we find an opening for those promises to be transferred to us, to the church. Which really, folks, Right? I mean, we have to think about this. Right? God made all of these many promises to Israel. And if because Israel failed in its keeping of the covenant, God then legitimately could take those promises away from Israel and give them to us, then do we not perceive what peril we are in? What is stopping God from taking those promises away from us and giving them to another? If all that is required is a lengthy succession of human failure for God to revoke, not the promise, but the recipient, because this is the argument. All of the promises stand firm, but they're just going to be passed off to another. Well, then, what protects us from being in the same place? What protects us from being cast away? So, right? So we come back. I come back. Again, we as a Baptist church, right? We are adamant about this, that although there is a temporary suspension in Israel's reception of the kingdom, that Israel as an ethnicity, as a national identity, is going to receive those promises. That God still has a plan for them. And that brings us then to Zechariah chapter 10. And I'm looking at the clock, and I think we're going to have plenty of time this morning. So let's take a minute to look at that, because I think that I just believe that it is an important And Zechariah itself is one of the most important books in helping us to understand the reality of the future of the nation of Israel. All right, so Zechariah chapter 10 and verse number 6. And I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph, and I will bring them again to place them. Now, I think that the literal fulfillment of that, folks, is the Valley of the Dry Bones, right? Which the Valley of the Dry Bones is not simply the resuscitation of the nation of Israel, but the reunification of Judah and Israel, the two distinct nations since the time of Solomon, back into one entity. And again, we're not, and maybe we should spend some time on that, but it seems to me that as that is going to happen, there is going to have to be some mechanism, some ability for Israel to be aware that that is what is happening. That their individual tribal people are being reconstituted as a people. Back to Zechariah 10:6. I will strengthen the house of Judah. I will save the house of Joseph. I will bring them again to place them, for I have mercy upon them, and they shall be as though I had not cast them off. They will be as though I had not cast them off, for I am the Lord their God and will hear them. So I realize that's one verse in the middle of many verses, but that is the declaration of the Lord. They will be as if I had not cast them off. He did cast them off. He did cast them off. He did, I don't want to say disown them, right? But he departed from them in a very real way in Ezekiel chapter 11. And when he returned to them in the person of Christ, they once again rejected him. So with that, let's look at Matthew chapter 23. All right, verse number seven, for those of you that are following along. Right? All that God has been promising and predicting will come to pass in reality, but the consummation is delayed. And in my notes, again, I put in parentheses just for my own safety and clarification, at least as we count time. Right? As we read through the Old Testament and we read through the promises and we read through the offer of the kingdom and we read about the rejection and we read about the response of that, we find ourselves, and by the way, when we get into Matthew 24, this will again become an inescapable part of our study, right? We're always in some way wrestling with both the clock and the calendar. So again, there is a very real sense in which biblically this is being presented to us as being delayed. And yet, in an equally real sense, right, it is right on the timetable that God had always anticipated, that God had always expected. So, right, and again, and so the reference there is Ezekiel 37 with the Valley of the Dry Bones and the reconstitution of the nation of Israel. Right, because Ezekiel is the man who is living not only, I mean, his ministry is not only at the time of the exile, he is one of the exiles. Right? He is one of those captured by the Babylonians in the demise of his nation. He is the man to whom is given the vision of the destruction of the temple. So he is the man who is on the receiving end of the vision of the dry bones. Will this nation ever come back? Will it ever come back and be reconstituted? Yes. And what will it be reconstituted as? Two nations? Because Ezekiel was living in the middle of the Babylonian captivity, but he was also living as a man who had come out of the Civil War long before his birth. But he's a Civil War era man. So he has no knowledge of, right? Or little, he probably has almost no knowledge of that that time. Right? Even when Assyria completely came in and devastated the northern tribes, I mean there is no chance he had anything to do with the actual civil war. But almost no reference at all to the very existence of Israel. But that's his vision, that Israel / Ephraim and Judah / Jerusalem are going to be reunited, constituted into one living, breathing nation. All right, so that brings us to Matthew. In Matthew chapter 12, of course, right, we have this momentous event of the Jews proclaiming that Jesus is operating in satanic power. That is followed by the mysteries of the kingdom, in which God is explaining aspects and dimensions of the kingdom that Israel had never seen and could not understand, not least of which is there's a time frame there that they did not anticipate. And then Jesus begins to talk about the way that the cross is going to be instrumental in the development of the kingdom, Matthew chapter 16. And now we come really to almost the very end. Matthew chapter 23, and let's just read verses 37 through 39. Now, Matthew 23 is a very harsh passage, by the way. This is the passage in which Jesus repeatedly calls Israel's leadership hypocrites. And he just blasts these people. It is unfortunately fodder for many fundamentalist pastors who believe that's the way to conduct themselves in the pulpit regularly, by throwing around a bunch of names and screaming and yelling at people. But Jesus wasn't really doing that. He was issuing divine judgments against the people who should have been leading the charge to welcome him. So, verse number 37, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them which are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me henceforth, till ye shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. So we are now on your outline at number 8. At number 8. In verse number 37, Jesus is chronicling their historical rejection. Their rejection of Jesus is not new, right? It's not like they had welcomed all that God had said and done and all of his leadership up until that moment and went, no, we just can't go here. Right? This was a history of rejection in spite of them being covenant people. That's why he talks about killing the prophets, stoning them that are sent unto thee. Right? Time after time after time after time, God rose up and sent them messengers. Time after time after time after time, they refused to listen. Or their listening was half-hearted, or their listening was temporary, but characteristically, it rejected, in spite of the fact that God's wish for them was to protect them and provide for them. And I think that you have there a very tender, we maybe not think of a chicken, you know, in a very tender sense, but it is a very tender image that he is presenting. In other words, right, it would be one thing, folks, if the people were rebelling against God's heavy-handed leadership, of God's unreasonable exercise of authority, of God being a typical dictator and taking advantage of his subjects, as the kings often did. Right? They became the king, and they levied heavy taxes. And, you know, they conscripted men into the military, and they used the nation for their own treasury, and so they abused them. But God's relationship with the nation of Israel was completely different. He was their protector. He was their provider. He didn't brutalize them. He never took advantage of them. He never made unreasonable demands upon them. Which, by the way, right, pause, nothing to do with the kingdom. Right? In our world, we are so hypersensitive about the concept of legalism that we almost view the Old Testament as an unreasonable document levied upon these people. That God had a lot of nerve to be that demanding. But he is in no way being unreasonable in what he asks of them. He is asking really only for one thing, that they be righteous toward him and righteous toward each other. That's what it's constituted. I mean, the reality, folks, is however you feel about the book of Leviticus when you read it, and it's not an easy read for us, right? The reality is that the biblical perspective of the Old Testament law is that that's what love looks like. What does it mean to love my neighbor as myself? Well, read Leviticus. That's love. So, right? So the Lord's position is that he has been kind and gracious to them, that he has forgiven their sins, that he has paid their debts, that he has provided for them abundantly, that he has protected them from their enemies, and all he has ever gotten in response is ingratitude and resistance and rebellion and being kicked in the face. So that brings us then to verse number 38, in which he predicts their destruction. He predicts their destruction. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. Right, so we need to talk about what exactly does Jesus mean there. And you've got it in your outline. The word house is used two ways, really, in the Bible. I've got it in the New Testament in the outline, right? One of those ways is to describe a physical structure. A house is a building. This is house. Paul said, you need to know how to behave yourself in the house of God. In the house of God, which may have both meanings in mind, right? But a reference there, you know, one of many, Matthew 11:8. What wouldn't you have to see a man clothed in soft raiment? Behold, they that wear soft clothing are in kings' houses. Right? If you want to see a guy dressed like royalty, you go to the palace. That's the point. But another way, a second way to use the word house in the Bible is by what we would call a dynasty or if you prefer, a dynasty, a lineage. As Matthew 10:6, go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But there's not some physical structure someplace that all the Jews live in. It's talking about the family, the dynasty. That's the way the word is used in the Old Testament about the midwives who didn't throw the baby boys into the Nile River. Right? God built them houses. He didn't build them physical structures. He established their family lineage. He provided for them in perpetuity. All right, so when we come to verse number 38, we ask this question, if Jesus means the word in the dynastic sense, then maybe this is the end of Israel. Right? Maybe Israel is at its end as a nation of people. But I think on the basis of verse number 39, and also, and we will get to this because we're just going to have to talk about it next week, right? The destruction of the temple in AD 70. Right? Jesus is almost certainly in verse number 38 using the word house to describe a physical structure, the temple. The temple. The temple is the structure, and it will be desolate. And the idea there of desolate is really deserted more than torn down stone undone. But Jesus will get to that, and we may just take a couple of minutes to preview if we have time at the very end there. Because one thing we never want to do, folks, and you know we'll talk about this when we transition into chapter 24, is we never want to let those chapter divisions create some kind of a wall between ideas. So that chapter 24, verse number 1, I think is a natural extension of 23:39. Jesus is talking about a physical structure. Chapter 24, verse number 1, Jesus departed from a physical structure, and the disciples are talking to him about a physical structure. So I think that's the continuity. So that in spite of their historical rejection, Jesus here has not announced this is the end of Israel. So, and then back to Matthew 23. So we have a historical rejection, a physical destruction, and a future restoration, verse number 39. For I say unto you, ye shall not see me hence till ye say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. Right, so I want to look at two passages here in the time. Let's go back to Zechariah chapter 12. My voice is giving out on me this morning. I don't know how it sounds to you. To me, it sounds like I've reverted back to being an 11-year-old where I can't decide if I have a little boy's voice or an adult voice. Zechariah chapter 12. Verse number 1. The burden of the word of the Lord for Israel, saith the Lord, which stretcheth forth the heavens, layeth the foundation of the earth, formeth the spirit of man within him. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day will I make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it. Now, I'm pausing here, and this is Ken Largent's commentary. When I read Zechariah 12:3, right, I hear God saying, Jerusalem is going to become to the armies of the world another Vietnam. It's going to be something easier to get into than it is going to be to extricate themselves from. It is going to be a weighty rock And when they get involved with it, they are going to discover, much to their dismay, that it isn't going to go the way they had thought. Verse number 4, in that day, saith the Lord, I will smite every horse with astonishment and his rider with madness. And I will open mine eyes upon the house of Judah and will smite every horse of the people with blindness. And the governors of Judah shall say in their heart, the inhabitants of Jerusalem shall be my strength and the Lord of hosts their God. In that day will I make the governors of Judah like an hearth of fire among the wood, and like a torch of fire in a sheaf, and they shall devour all the people round about. Now, okay, you may not have it, you may not be a great note writer, you can put it on your outline here, but I would write here at Zechariah 12, 5 and 6, make a note to go back and read Psalm 110. Thy people shall be willing in the day of thy power. In the beauties of holiness thou hast the dew of the morning. In that day, right there, there is coming a day, folks, when Jerusalem will be besieged. Right? Now, again, and I'm not trying to ridicule those who hold it, but we can say here it is, AD 70 in the destruction of the temple. But the problem, folks, is that what happened at Jerusalem in AD 70 is not what happens in Zechariah 12. All of those armies, I mean, here is the city completely besieged, and it is going to be a brutal bloodbath. Make no doubt about that. God himself is very clear. There are going to be incredible numbers of Israelites killed, and the women are all going to be ravished. It is not going to be a pretty picture for anybody. And at some critical moment, right, things are going to shift. And the thing that is going to shift is Israel is going to go something like, we need Jehovah. And then the tide is going to begin to turn, and the Lord himself is going to reinvigorate his people, and he is going to come to their rescue. So verse 6, in that day will I make the governors of Judah like a hearth of fire among the wood. They're going to burn like a consuming fire, and like a torch of fire in a sheaf, and they shall devour all the people round about on the right hand and on the left, and Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. The Lord also shall save the tents of Judah first, that the glory of the house of David and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem do not magnify themselves against Judah. In that day shall the Lord defend the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and he that is feeble among them at that day shall be as David, and the house of David shall be as God, and the angel of the Lord before them. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will seek to destroy all the nations that come against Jerusalem, and I will pour upon the house of David and upon the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and of supplications. And they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn for him as one mourneth for his only son, and shall be in bitterness for him as one that is in bitterness for his firstborn. They will come to a place, folks, of tremendous personal regret. And by the way, if I could just make a note here, this is off at a tangent, right? If you find yourself in a serious conversation with a Jehovah's Witness about the person and identity of Christ, two verses you never want to forget are Zechariah 12:10 and John 19:37. Because here it says, they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and John 19 quotes it as they shall look upon him whom they have pierced, about Jesus. Jesus is Jehovah. Human body is the difference. Human body is the difference. Right? So this is what is anticipated. And then one other passage that we want to add to that, which is Psalm 118. I'm just going to start reading it very quickly. Psalm 18, verse number 1. Oh, give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good, because his mercy endureth forever. Let Israel now say that his mercy endureth forever. Let the house of Aaron now say that his mercy endureth forever. Let them now that fear the Lord say that his mercy endureth forever. I called upon the Lord in distress. The Lord answered me and set me in a large place. The Lord is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do unto me? The Lord taketh my part with them that help me. Therefore shall I see my desire upon them that hate me. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in man. It is better to trust in the Lord than to put confidence in princes. All nations compass me about, but in the name of the Lord will I destroy them. They compassed me about, yea, they compassed me about, but in the name of the Lord I will destroy them. They compassed me about like bees. They are quenched as the fire of thorns, for in the name of the Lord I will destroy them. Thou hast thrust sore at me that I might fall, but the Lord helped me. The Lord is my strength and song, and has become my salvation. The voice of rejoicing and salvation is in the tabernacles of the righteous. The right hand of the Lord doeth valiantly. The right hand of the Lord is exalted. The right hand of the Lord doeth valiantly. I shall not die but live and declare the works of the Lord. The Lord hath chastened me sore, but he hath not given me over unto death. Open to me the gates of righteousness. I will go in them, into them, and I will praise the Lord. The gate of the Lord into which the righteous shall enter, I will praise thee, for thou hast heard me and art become my salvation. The stone which the builders refused has become the head of the stone of the corner. We, of course, know this is ultimately about Christ. But, folks, in Christ and Israel, we see parallels, and this is where Isaiah and the servant songs really come to play. The stone which the builders refused has become the headstone of the corner. This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes. This is the day which the Lord hath made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. Which technically is the day of crucifixion. Save now, I beseech thee, O Lord. O Lord, I beseech thee, send now prosperity. Blessed be he that cometh in the name of the Lord. We have blessed you out of the house of the Lord. God is the Lord, which hath showed us light. Bind the sacrifice with cords, even unto the horns of the altar. Thou art my God, I will praise thee. Thou art my God, I will exalt thee. O give thanks unto the Lord, for he is good. For his mercy endureth forever. There is the specific quote. We read all that to get to the specific quote, right? We have blessed you out of the house of the Lord. You will not see me again until this is brought to fulfillment. And quite honestly, folks, if you look at it, both in Psalm 118 and Matthew 23:39, you've got the note there. I pretty much gave you my outline. What is most certainly, it seems to me, being outlined, right? Here is one of those places where the initiative does lie with the people. They will call for him and he will appear. Not that he will appear and they will welcome him, but they will call for him and he will appear. And then this will bring about, I think, what God has long desired, what he has argued for as his mandate for the nation of Israel. Isaiah 2:11, the lofty looks of man shall be humbled, the haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. The Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. This is what God has desired for Israel, even way back in Isaiah's day, even back at the very beginning, that Israel would have no other God. Nothing other strong for them other than Jehovah. And so that brings me then to the last point on the outline. Look at that. I'm going to stop right on time today. This is a red letter day. Right? The point of all this, I think, the point of all this, not the only point, but with reference to what we're doing, is that it eliminates the idea that national Israel is out of the picture. In other words, folks, how do we find a fulfillment in Matthew 23:39 if it is not fulfilled in Israel? And again, there are those who argue, well, it will be fulfilled by the church, but perhaps we'll undertake this, but Israel and church are not synonyms. There, you have to come up with some viable mechanism to turn us into them in that kind of way. And that is, by the way, that is not the rapture. We'll get into this in the Olivet Discourse, in which I'm going to pretty much argue that the rapture is not really, it is certainly not prominent in any way, shape, or form. Right? We're talking about the second coming, the second time that Jesus comes to planet Earth. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. It's 10:46 according to my clock up here, and we'll be back at 11 o'clock. Thank you.